The following interview is brought to you by the Mile High Sanity Project. Think responsibly. Welcome to the Mile High Sanity Project, everybody. Here we are today. And we've got a fun guest with us. Let's get right to it here. My name is Nick, and I'm one of the co-hosts. I'm here with my buddies, Norm Schultz.
Hi.
Chalmer Wren.
Hello.
Our guest today, he's an evolutionary biologist and a former Oxford University professor for the public understanding of science. He has authored several game-changing books throughout the years, just to name a few: The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, The God Delusion, and more recently, The Greatest Show on Earth. And he's coming to a venue near you to promote a fantastic new book by Catherine Stewart. It's The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Assault on America's Children. And it will actually be in Denver, Colorado on Thursday, February 28 at 7 p.m. with Catherine. So, my friends, the secular community does not have any holy figures. But if we did, this man would still not be one, because that would be ridiculous. The project is pleased to welcome Richard Dawkins.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your time here. Well, let's get right into some of these questions we've got for you here. To start with, I was wondering, how did you find out about Stewart's book?
Well, I was sent it to read, and I read it with great attention. And then I met her, I had lunch with her, I spent part of an afternoon with her in New York, and greatly enjoyed her company, and was horrified by the story that she had to tell.
Yes,
about the Good News Club.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. So, I mean, speaking of that then, like, what was it that interested you about the content of this book in particular?
Well, I'm not American, as you can gather, and so the idea of the separation of church and state is not something that in Britain we have, rather to my regret. But it's very clear that the Good News Club is a subversive organization that infiltrates schools, right, and, as it were, gets below the radar of the, I think it's the First Amendment, isn't it, the separation of church and state,
yeah. Right.
By going into schools the moment the school bell rings for the end of the school day, and, as it were, masquerading as a set of teachers. The children, in many cases, actually think they are teachers when they're not. They're religious propagandists who are there to essentially subvert the children's education with fundamentalist religion.
Right. Yeah, I know Ms. Stewart talks about the fact that, you know, children at that age, they can't make the distinction between you know, who's working for the school and who's not, and this seems to be kind of part of the plan of this group. So,
it's very much part of the plan, and you can hear it explicitly. There are various videos of them talking, and they're quite honest about it. They're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it.
Right.
They're proud of getting
in
there and masquerading as though they're teachers, and because they're in the classroom, because they're in the same situation as the teachers would be, they look like teachers, they sound like teachers, the children think they are teachers.
Right. Well, they're very result-oriented, so a lot of the subversive activity doesn't seem to really bother them at all.
That's correct.
Right. And, of course, yeah, I had the same reaction. I haven't finished reading her book, but, you know, I've gotten to the point where it's a little hard to shock me, and I found, okay, yeah, I guess you can shock me. Not that there are groups that do this, but the access that they're legally allowed, that's what really bothered me. I don't know that there's anything that, you know, we here in the United States can easily do about this, but so that's something that worries me with this topic as well.
Well, it worries me. It's something that puzzled me. It's something to do with a Supreme Court decision, and I don't really understand how that happened.
Yeah.
But it looks as though the Supreme Court, for some reason, let this through. They must have slipped up in some way. And so, and the Good News Club themselves are cock-a-hoop about it. They're crowing about this Supreme Court judgment, which allowed them in.
That's a major victory for them, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't remember the Supreme Court decision specifically, but I know in 2001 there was a lot of talk about faith-based initiatives here, mm-hmm, in the United States, and that you know, technically they should be regarded as the same as non-faith-based initiatives, because they should have the freedom to act like a company or another organization when it comes to after-school programs.
I
think that's,
yes,
how it worked.
And quite, yes, often they will use things like the freedom of speech to say that,
right,
rejecting their right to get into the schools or to run these kinds of programs is actually a violation of their rights. And many of the legal organizations set up for the Christian right have kind of taken this slant at the issue.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know that there's any way to prevent a religious organization from doing this kind of thing. I think about the only thing that one can do is raise awareness and try to encourage school districts to make a clear distinction for the kids that this is not sponsored by the school. So I don't know. We were going to move on to another question, this is my question to you, and I want to preface this question with this. When I was researching, you know, what to ask you for this interview, I kind of had a hard time coming up with questions, because usually, because of my personality, I ask questions about things I disagree with, and I have a hard time finding things I disagree with you about, so... this is the best that I could come up with. You've talked about the problem of indoctrination of children before. I heard of this in your series, The Enemies of Reason, and it's also discussed in The God Delusion. Is there any way that you could just talk more about how you feel about the indoctrination of children with religion, and also if you could speak to kind of, I regard this as Sam Harris's point that we as a society give religion free pass to do things that we wouldn't otherwise allow them to do. So could you just speak to,
yes,
to that topic a little bit?
I think Sam's point is completely right. I actually approve of religious education in the sense of teaching children about religion, teaching children that religion exists, teaching children that there are people called Christians, there are people called Muslims, people called Jews. Within Christians, there are Catholics and Protestants and so on. I think it's important for children to know that this goes on in the world. Otherwise, they can't understand world affairs. They can't understand history. Right. There are two things that I think are actually tantamount to child abuse. One is labeling children mm-hmm. with the religion of their parents, telling children, you are a Catholic child, you are a Protestant child, you are a Muslim child, especially a very young child who's obviously much too young to know what her opinions are right. about the universe and about morality. So to call a child, to call a four-year-old child a Catholic child seems to me to be tantamount to child abuse. Mm-hmm. And to get that point across, you've only got to imagine that somebody talked about an existential child,
right.
or a postmodernist child, or a right. yeah. secular humanist yeah. child. And the moment you say that, everybody laughs. Of course you wouldn't do that. Right. And yet religion is the one thing that gets a free pass to be allowed to label children as though they automatically inherit the religion of their parents almost by genetic means. Right, and that's right. wicked. The other thing that's wicked is terrifying children by telling them they're going to hell if they sin. And this, I think, the Good News Club quite clearly does. And this is very, very wicked indeed. There's good evidence that children are terrified, psychologically damaged, by being told about the terrifying threat of hell after you're dead.
Sure.
There's a kind of inverse relationship between the horror of a threat and the implausibility of it. And for adults, you really need to make hell seem very, very horrible indeed in order to overcome the intrinsic implausibility of the idea that you ever would go to hell.
Right.
But with a child, they believe what adults tell them, especially if they think those adults are teachers. And so going into schools and telling children that they're going to hell, or telling so-called Catholic children that Protestant children are going to hell, which does happen, that is very wicked indeed again.
Right. You know, just to play devil's advocate on the labeling issue that you have, I think people tend to blur the line between their culture and their religion. And I'm not, I don't know, couldn't someone say that it's appropriate to label a child by what culture they are from, and if that's a religious culture, then it's appropriate to do that?
I suppose that's right if all you're talking about is the kind of customs they have, the way they celebrate Christmas, the sort of possibly clothes they wear in the case of
right.
of Jews, say.
Or Muslims, yeah.
Yes, and I don't think that's objectionable, but when it's linked up with a particular view of the universe, of the cosmos, of the origin of all things, of the origins of morality and so on, then you're committing the child to a particular philosophy, which happens to be the philosophy of their parents.
Right.
And that, I think, really is wicked.
Yeah,
definitely, yeah. Definitely.
I agree completely that, I mean, hell as a concept is the worst possible punishment.
It's supposed to be.
Yeah, by definition. So I guess, like you said, by comparison, it's probably the most implausible as well.
Well, I think you're next with the next question.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the right-wing narrative of history in American public education. Stewart, in her book, says, today there's more religious activity in the classroom than there has been for the last 100 years. That it's not a grassroots initiative, that we're not whittling away at religion in public schools, but that we're whittling away at secularism. And I'm curious if you've seen anything like this in the United Kingdom, this well-organized, funded deception of the public.
Well, as I said before, we don't have a separation of church and state. We actually do have a state religion, the Church of England.
Sure.
So there is not the same kind of constitutional commitment to separation. The Church of England is a fairly mild strain of the virus, if I can put it that way.
Right. Certainly,
And so Church of England schools, on the whole, are rather innocuous. I and my colleagues have noticed is that there's a strong influx of Muslim influence in Britain, which I think you probably don't have to the same extent in the United States.
Right.
Yeah. And this shows itself in the most extraordinary effects in biological education. But my colleagues teaching biology at university level are finding Muslim, I don't mind calling them Muslim students because they're adult, Muslim students walking out of lectures because they're talking about evolution.
Right.
These are students who intend to become doctors. I mean, these are medical students.
That's happening at the university level?
Yeah, that's at university level. These are 19, 20-year-olds. I'm very disturbed by this.
Yeah,
I'm very disturbed by the idea that we could be actually qualifying doctors who have this bizarre view of the world. They don't believe that we have evolved.
Well, let's hope that they don't become they don't study viruses and things like that. They really need knowledge of evolution. These guys are pointing to another question that
feeds off of
we
this.
We feel like our fifth question is a better lead-in. Well, let me just ask.
Oh, right, yeah.
I'll ask my question real quick because I think it'll be kind of a fast one. Like you said, you don't really have the equivalent there. But the question I have is, what can we really do to combat it? We're not a well organized collective effort. We're not part of a
single, by we, Chalmer. Who
I mean, the
about?
Secular community.
Oh, okay.
Concerned about these kind of issues. What would you recommend as Americans concerned about the issues we can do about organizations like the Good News Club?
Well, my answer to that kind of question is always consciousness raising. This is a phrase that the feminists have introduced into the language, and I think it's a very good one. I employed consciousness raising a moment ago when I was talking about labeling and said, you know, how absurd it would be to talk about an existentialist child or a postmodernist child.
Right.
And that's consciousness raising. That's not trying to get the law changed. That's not trying to go to court or anything like that. That would be going to perhaps the parents, to the teachers in the school, pointing out to the teachers what's actually going on, pointing out to the parents what's being done to their children, raising consciousness. And I suspect that people would respond to that if you go out to them and talk to them in sensible ways about that. They would be horrified.
I just thought of a great idea. How about a flying spaghetti monster after school program?
Well, that, yes, I mean, something like that. That might be a little bit too absurd. But if you pointed out that there's no particular reason why Christianity, as opposed to, the Olympian gods, Thor, I'm sorry, those were the Norse gods, Thor and Wotan, and the Olympian gods.
Zeus
and Apollo and things.
Right.
or the Hindu gods, or indeed the Muslim Allah.
Mm-hmm.
It's an arbitrary stroke of luck that your children happen to have been brought up in a Christian society. And if they hadn't, if they'd been brought up in Afghanistan or Indonesia, they'd been Muslim and so on. There are all sorts of ways you can raise consciousness. I think also in America that you do have the advantage that there is this strong reverence for the Constitution.
Right.
And it shouldn't be that difficult to persuade parents and teachers that this is unconstitutional.
Right. The problem, though, that we have that I think probably isn't as significant in the United or in the UK is that something like almost 90% of Americans never leave North America. So a lot of people that live here don't really have a sense of what's going on in other parts of the world, and I think a lot of them have a backwards outlook on world religions. And I think when you learn about other religions, you start to ask more fundamental questions, and I think that there's not enough of that happening in the United States, especially in school-aged children. So they tend to not see as much of the world as I think they probably do in the UK.
Well, possibly. It's true that the statistics on the number of United States citizens who actually have passports and ever travel abroad is quite low.
Yeah.
And knowledge of world geography, I think, is often quite low.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah. Or caring about world geography. We're so kind of self-absorbed.
Okay.
The next question that I had kind of – this is just a personal – it's related, but it's somewhat of in a different direction. I always wonder about someone who is, like yourself, a scientist and, noted atheist. How do you account for people that you meet in the science community, whether they be scientists themselves or just science educators, who are religious or even to the extreme don't believe in evolution? I have a hard time wrapping my head around how people reconcile these conflicting beliefs.
There aren't that many of them, I think. And we tend to pick out those ones who are and marvel at them.
Right.
I mean, the number who are actually creationists is very small, and they're actually not proper scientists at all. You can write them off. I mean,
right.
They're not to be taken seriously.
Makes sense.
There are some who are call themselves religious, ask them when you meet them what they actually believe in.
Right.
Because it'll often turn out that really they're not religious at all. They are vaguely spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They will say something like, oh, well, there's a lot that we don't yet understand. They'll sound a bit like Einstein. And Einstein used God language as a sort of metaphor for that which we don't understand. When Einstein wanted to say, Einstein said, the question I really want to know is, did God have a choice in designing the universe? What he meant was, is there only one kind of universe that there could be? Is there only one way in which a universe could be?
Right.
Or could there be lots of different kinds of universes? Einstein chose to put it in God language. That was his really poetic way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he chose God language, which gives the religious people a field day because they can claim Einstein as one of their own.
Yeah.
I mean, when Einstein became aware of this, he was extremely indignant and protested vigorously that he did not believe in a personal God.
Right.
So very often, the scientists you meet who you are told that they're religious, if you actually ask them what they believe, it turns out they're no more religious than Einstein was. There are some who are religious. There are some who actually believe in Jesus, actually believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, you can count them on the fingers of one hand, but they're there.
Right.
I mean, you can count the distinguished ones on the fingers of one hand, people like Francis Collins.
Right.
But it's the same names keep cropping up. I mean, it's Francis Collins, it's John Polkinghorne. There are about three or four others. They are rare.
Right.
And if you talk to them, it looks as though what they're doing is somehow walling off that part of their mind that does science from the part of their mind that does religion. They somehow manage to keep these two personalities separate in their minds. If you meet somebody who actually, a scientist who actually believes the world is less than 10,000 years old, then he's a disgrace. He doesn't deserve the title of scientist at all.
I also wonder if it's attachment to their family that makes them not want to rock the boat, or other things that are not less obvious that are
community,
going on.
Community
and cultural ties, maybe.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that which would lead them to not actually speak out, yes.
Right.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, I do see this a lot working in a scientific field. Most of my colleagues who express any kind of religious ideas are usually in that vague, fuzzy, spiritual area.
Yes.
And then the experts, like Francis Collins, are typically relying on the same sort of tired, bad arguments that everyone else is. So it's certainly not a new scientific eye on the argument or the point that they're trying to make. It's typically the same thing everyone else has already said.
Yeah.
Yes.
So our next question, I'm sure you're aware that here in the United States, we have a bit of a problem with the public understanding of evolution. and we don't do apparently a very good job of educating people in how science works, etc. What would you say is the number one thing that the public does not understand about evolution?
This is a very puzzling thing. I mean, the figures are hovering around somewhere above 40% of people who actually believe that the world is young. I mean, they seem to believe that the whole of life arose within the last 10,000 years,
right?
Which is a very, very startling error indeed. It's an error of huge magnitude. And it is worrying. It's been steady ever since the 1980s. It's not a new phenomenon.
Right.
I think that it's probably because of the subversive effects of religion. Evolution is not that difficult to understand. I mean, we're not talking about quantum theory or relativity here. It's actually not that difficult to understand. There are barriers to understanding. One of the barriers is the enormous spans of time that are involved.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years, and the human mind is not geared to comprehend that sort of time span. So you find a lot of people who say, well, I can understand about what they call microevolution.
Right.
It takes place in a matter of a few thousand years. But I can't believe that a fish could turn into a reptile. And that's just because they don't get the fact that given a sufficiently large amount of time,
mm-hmm.
microevolution, given a large amount of time, can turn into macroevolution. And I suppose it's a related point is that, you know, I've never seen a monkey turn into a human. That you hear that a lot.
Right.
And that, again, is because they sort of imagine that what we're talking about is a kind of overnight transformation rather than something that takes tens of millions of years, far longer than you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
Ernst Mayr, the great German-American biologist, one of the founding fathers of the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, blamed Platonic Aristotelian essentialism, the idea that living things are rather like geometric figures. They have an essence. There's an essence of rabbit,
right.
An essence of rhinoceros, and you can only do minor changes. You can't actually change a rabbit into anything else. And that's a kind of cultural prejudice which we have to overcome. And those are sort of, in a way, almost, you could almost call them kind of genuine conceptual difficulties. But I think the main one is actually religion. I mean, I think that religion is a subversive influence which actually positively teaches people to doubt the truth of Darwinian evolution.
Right. It sounds to me like you're also saying that philosophy has not done this idea of essentialism too many favors, and unfortunately I have to agree with you because I have a love-hate relationship with my field, so
yes,
I fear that is true.
And Ernst Mayr wanted to replace essentialism with what he called population thinking. So there is no essential rabbit. There's a population of existing rabbits, which is a normal bell-shaped distribution. And you have extremes at either end of the bell shape. And given a few hundred generations, what at present is the tail of the bell-shaped distribution can become the mode, the center of the future bell-shaped distribution. And that is population thinking. And that's actually the way evolution happens.
Huh. Well, I'll have to give that some more thought. I haven't read what you're talking about. There are modern analytic philosophers who talk about the idea that concepts are equally there in the world and constructed by human interests, and so we have to keep this in mind. And this would apply to, you know, any division that you would make. You know, the division between species is a perfect example. So, but that's a difficult idea to communicate, and I'm going to have to give that more thought as well.
Well, it does make sense that we categorize our thinking to aid understanding. I mean, you look at Linnaean classifications, we're really talking about sort of seamless transitions between organisms.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's a sort of artifact of the fact that most creatures that ever lived have gone extinct. So we do have clear distinctions between species. But if you do a thought experiment and imagine that all the animals that have gone extinct were still alive, then categorization into separate species would be impossible. There'd be no such thing as a species. You just have to classify animals in some kind of mathematical, graphical way. They would merge into each other by insensible, gradual degrees.
How about by color? We could just do it by color.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to do it by color, by size, by length, shape, by all sorts of measurements. You couldn't say,
scariness.
You couldn't have an argument, is this Homo sapiens or is it Homo erectus?
Huh.
There would be all intermediates between them. You'd have to give up giving them names.
And I like this thought experiment you introduce in your newest work, as well as in The Ancestor's Tale. Of going back through time, sort of one individual at a time, to see that more seamless transition, rather than thinking of graduations or individuals that transition through leaps.
Yes.
Okay. So,
I think Nick has the next question.
Yes,
I do. I got a question here. You've talked about how science continually updates itself, jettisoning outdated beliefs in favor of new evidence, and this is a major distinguishing factor between science and religious dogma. And I was just wondering if you could think of a biology example that has occurred within your lifetime where a once popular belief was replaced by a new one once new information and better evidence was discovered.
Well, there are particular factual points. I mean, I was utterly flabbergasted to discover that whales, molecular evidence shows that whales spring from right within the middle of the cloven-hoofed animals. It's not just that whales are sort of related to the entire group of cloven-hoofed animals. Whales come from right within the middle of the cloven-hoofed animals. They come from, their closest cousins are hippos. Hippos' closest cousins are whales.
That's crazy.
Hippos' closest cousins are not pigs, as I was taught as an undergraduate. They're whales. And it's just that because whales have moved into the sea and therefore have been completely liberated from the constraints of living on land, that they've become so radically different and unrecognizable as cousins of hippos. So that's a particular factual example which has been brought to light by molecular research. And there'll be a lot more like that, I suspect.
That's great. That's a great example, too. I would never have thought that. Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's more of a specialized example.
It is. That's correct. It is more of a specialized example.
I think that the public is actually finds the fact that science revises itself, they find that disturbing. That is frequently used by religious people as a sign that you shouldn't trust science.
Yeah.
It's a fundamental misunderstanding of human knowledge and science, I think.
Yes, it's sort of the beauty of science, really. But these are not necessarily major overturnings. I mean, those happen as well, of course, but mostly they're minor changes. The thing I just told you about whales and hippos is startling to anybody brought up as a zoologist as I was, but it doesn't change the fundamental rule that everything evolves by right. gradual degrees by Darwinian natural selection.
Right.
It's, so, it's only a detailed change.
So I wonder, Darwin was onto something.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah.
I wonder if there will be any real revolutions in biology, like there. You know, when you talk about physics, you know that there's going to be some sort of major revolution at some point, hopefully in the near future. You know, with things like unifying the forces or understanding dark matter, there's going to be some, you know, big surprises. I wonder if there will be any with biology.
Yes, I mean that we certainly ought to be alert to that possibility. The history of the philosophy of science is often based upon physics, and so you have philosophers of science love to look at Newtonian gravity and contrast it with Einstein's general theory
right.
of relativity, and I point out that Newton's mathematics still kind of work,
right?
But don't work for with total precision. Newton never actually had a theory of gravitation. It was just he had a mathematical law that described it.
Yeah.
If we look at my own field of evolution, is Darwinian evolution ever going to be completely overthrown? I would be hugely surprised if it was.
Right.
I think that details will be changed, and they are being changed all the time. But I think it's always going to be true that that life evolves, that living things are cousins of each other, that any pair of species you care to mention has a shared ancestor, which must have lived at some particular date in fossil history. I don't think that's ever going to change.
Right.
The guiding force that at least produces adaptation, that produces the illusion of design, that's natural selection. That isn't going to change. There is controversy about how important natural selection is versus other evolutionary forces, such as random chance, such as so-called neutral theory.
Right.
And that's important. That's interesting, but I don't think anybody is going to supersede Darwinian natural selection as an explanation for why animals look so well designed.
Right.
Details will change, but not the fundamentals.
You know what I wonder about is abiogenesis, because I'm not being in the field of biology. My impression of abiogenesis as a field, I'm not even sure if it should be called that, but as a inquiry, is that it is in scientific disarray. That
it's one of the great mysteries. It's one of the things that remain to be solved: the origin of life. How do we get from chemistry to biology? How do we get it amounts to the first gene. I don't mean DNA. I mean the first self-replicating, self-copying molecule.
Right,
you've got to have something self-replicating, something that does the job of DNA, or you can't get natural selection going. Once natural selection's going, then the whole of the rest of biological evolution follows.
Right.
So abiogenesis, the genesis of biology from chemistry,
right.
is a great problem, and it's something that we may never solve. It's something that happened perhaps 4 billion years ago,
right,
when conditions on the Earth were very different.
Right.
People who work on it are looking for a plausible theory. They're looking for a model which, and it's largely a problem in chemistry, a chemical model for the origin of a self-replicating molecule with the right properties, the right degree of high fidelity and various other properties.
Mm-hmm.
And promising models are coming to light.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, the currently most fashionable family of theories is the so-called RNA world.
Oh, right.
What we have at present is in biology, we have a kind of partnership between DNA,
mm-hmm,
which is a very, very good, high-fidelity, efficient replicator, carrier of information, and protein, which is a terrible carrier of information, but a very good executor, a very good, I mean, it does it by being enzymes. Chemical reactions are hugely speeded up by enzymes, by specific catalysts, which speed up chemical reactions. And the whole of life is controlled by enzymes, which are mostly proteins. Well, proteins are terrible self-replicators. DNA is not an enzyme at all. RNA is a bit of both. RNA is a moderately inefficient replicator and a moderately inefficient enzyme. But it's good enough at both that one can speculate, and people are speculating, that the origin of life lay with RNA, which performed both these roles, both the role that was later usurped by DNA and the role that was later taken over by protein.
And you mean the production of energy and the ability to transmit data? Are those the two roles?
Those are the two roles which are now respectively carried out by protein and by DNA. And the theory is that RNA once upon a time did both.
Okay.
And then the transmission of information function was taken over by DNA, which does it better. And the enzyme function was taken over by protein, which does it better. And RNA remains in a very important mediation role.
Yeah, we still have examples of it acting both as a carrier of information and as carrying out catalytic activity.
Yes.
Can I attend a class where you teach about this? I would really enjoy that. That would be fun. You're not really teaching that much anymore.
No, not really. I'm sure you can attend something near where you are.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah.
Who's next? I'm losing a little bit.
We're on question 8.
So is it me? Oh,
we got two more questions.
Okay, I've got one more question. Do you think that? Do you think that we're generally moving the direction of societies becoming more hostile to religion, as far as a more hostile environment for religious belief, because of sociological or technological changes? Do you think we're going that direction, or?
I am optimistic. When you look worldwide, there are great areas of darkness. The Islamic world is an area of darkness. But even that's looking slightly more cheerful. As computers become cheaper and more powerful, as Moore's law bites, people in places like Pakistan are more exposed to the rest of the world, Afghanistan, so that they are not so benighted, not so turned in upon themselves with their dreadful dependence on mullahs and so-called clerics for their education. So that we may be moving in the right direction there. In the United States, well, in Western Europe, things are going very well, except for Islam, of course.
Right.
But, I mean, Scandinavian countries are more or less totally non-religious anymore. Britain is going in the right direction. France is going in the right direction. United States is going in the right direction. It's just got further to go. The United States is, without any doubt, the world's leading scientific nation and the world's leading intellectual nation, I would say. But it's only half the country. The other half of the country is, you could call, kind of Sarah Palin territory.
Sure.
Which is anti-intellectual, anti-education, ignorant. Fortunately, the intellectual half of the United States is so powerful that it's carrying the country along.
Well, yeah, a lot of us in the skeptic community here think that there's something that's changing, that people are more open about being skeptics and atheists, and we're finding these different, disparate groups growing in numbers, and it's a little hard to organize skeptics and atheists.
It is. I mean, very encouraged, and my foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, is trying to be active in the United States, and we're pretty encouraged. I mean, we find support wherever we go, even in the so-called Bible Belt, actually, especially in the so-called Bible Belt, where we seem to get the most enthusiastic audiences that we encounter at all. You can kind of see why that is. I mean, they feel beleaguered and threatened.
Right.
But we do get huge audiences in places like Kansas and Kentucky and Alabama.
Yeah.
And I find that very encouraging. And I think that when I go and lecture in such places, You can more or less see the people there turning out in their thousands, literally thousands, and getting encouragement from each other. I mean, getting encouragement by noticing how big the audience is mm-hmm. and realizing, good heavens, I'm not alone. Yeah, I'm a member of quite a large group here. Yeah. And what we're trying to do is to make use of that and to encourage them to organize after I've left the area,
right,
and form local groups, local organizations.
Well, I was I guess very encouraged before reading the Good News Club because it's got quite a bit of bad news in it. But I've read recently that in my generation, I'm in my mid-20s, that people in my generation are predominantly secular or non-religious in categorizing themselves, or simply vaguely spiritual. That's very encouraging.
That is hugely encouraging indeed, yes.
And I've been an organizer for some time, and I found increasing support over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yes, that's right. I mean, another fact is it's statistically demonstrated that both across different countries and across the states within the United States, religiosity tends to go with poverty, with all the various indices of social deprivation.
Sure.
And so to the extent that there are improved living standards, improved health care, things like that, you tend to get a drop-off in religiosity.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And one of our most successful things we did was the Food for Free Thought, which you had donated some books to for us, where we gave out food in exchange for food donations. Donations, excuse me. And we got, within a day, we got hundreds of pounds of food that we were able to drop off. And that's on a college campus with people my age. It is very encouraging.
It's like feeding the 5,000, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed.
Basically the same thing.
Well, that was must have been self-replicating,
self-replicating bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so, Nick, I think you have the last question.
I do. It just kind of feeds off of what we were just talking about a little here. I mean, you know, you've been working to raise public awareness in the secular community about the dangers of religious ideology for, you know, more than 30 years now. And I was just wondering how you think we as a secular community, how are we doing against, you know, when it comes to spreading the word, I guess the good word of secularism.
Consciousness raising.
Right. How are we doing? What grade would you give us?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound complacent. I'm reasonably optimistic. I mean, we're such nice people, for one thing. And we've got education on our side. We've got social progress on our side. We've got history on our side. I mean, history in general is moving in the right direction. The kind of sawtooth up and down motion, but two steps forward, one step back.
Oh, right.
I think we're doing all right.
That's good.
But let's keep working at it.
That's
Don't
right.
Let's
get
complacent.
I mean, what do you think we should be doing better? Any areas that we should be focusing on our attentions on that we're not doing enough of?
Well, I keep coming back to consciousness raising. There's a controversy in our world between people who think we should be appeasing and should be wooing the sort of moderate religious people and trying to get them on our side, and people who think we should be ridiculing them. I think there's room for both. And I don't want to be dogmatic about what's the right approach. I think it would be too dogmatic to say we've got to be appeasing all the time. We've got to be just sort of, you know, bending over backwards to be nice to religious people.
Right.
I think that there is a place for ridicule, but I think that there's a place for both, and it's right that we should be using both techniques.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Well, I think we've taken up enough of your evening. We, again, greatly appreciate you calling into the show.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I think there was one more thing that we were hoping you would do for us. It's a 5-second little thing. Nick, do you want to?
Yeah, I was wondering if you would mind giving us a little bumper that we could put maybe in promos for ourselves. Just maybe say, you know, this is Richard Dawkins, and you're listening to the Mile High Sanity Project.
This is Richard Dawkins. You're listening to the Mile High Sanity Project.
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing that.
Okay.
Have a great evening, and look forward to you coming out to Denver.
Fine. Nice to speak to you. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Good night.
Bye-bye.
This has been a presentation of the Mile High Sanity Project. There is a good chance that we agree with the views expressed in this interview, but if backed into a corner, we will adamantly refuse to commit ourselves one way or the other.